Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Welcome to the Book Review program here on Radio Islam International on this lovely Monday morning. We do have Maulana Ashraf Dokrat with us on the line. Maulana, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
I hope Maulana is doing well and jazakumullah khairan for joining us this morning on the Book Review program. Now, Maulana, an interesting book that we look at this morning, it was the Sunday Times bestseller, the book titled The Anarchy. It seems like this book is about the East India Company, Maulana.
Yes, Maulana, this, like you say, the book The Anarchy, subtitled The Relentless Rise of the East India Company. This is the British subtitle. The American subtitle was, when it was published there, The East India Company, Corporate Violence, and the Pillage of an Empire. So a more provocative subtitle for the American audience. But like you say, this is a new book by William Dalrymple. We have reviewed his other books on this program, The White Mogul, The Last Mogul, Return of a King, and the latest one we did was Kohinoor, The History of the World's Most Infamous Diamond. William Dalrymple, the author, is a well-known and a renowned history. So this book is about the remarkable story of how the East India Company managed to replace the mighty Mughal Empire as masters of the vast Indian subcontinent and traces their development from 1756 right up to 1803. The East India Company was formed in 1599, and at the time, England was a small, poor agricultural country, while India had a population of 150 million people and accounted for one-fifth of the entire world's population. It was also an industrial powerhouse and led the world in manufacturing textiles. The Indian Mughal Emperor was by far the richest monarch in the world. But then, like the title of the book suggests, anarchy followed. And the anarchy that is meant and referred to in this book refers to then the disintegration of the Mughal India that followed with the death of the Emperor Aurangzeb Alamgir Rahmatullah Ali in 1707. From there, we found that religious divisions, devastating Persian and Afghan invasions, and also a series of weak and unstable rulers, and very powerful then regional wazirs and rulers, left this emperor completely, and this empire completely at its knees. The heir, Shah Alam, was then exiled from Delhi at this time. So the book shows how the Mughal empire was then replaced by this company, this private company, which was in a sense dangerous because it was completely unregulated. It was based, in another continent, thousands of kilometers away, and it was able then to form there in the small office of five windows wide that answered to nobody except its shareholders. They were able to wield this type of power. Many startups, the East India Company started off very modestly. At that time, the Dutch East India Company was much more sophisticated than them. They operated in the Spice Islands. Even the French and the Portuguese, apart from the Dutch, were doing much better than the British at that time. The East India Company then turned its attention to India. And Queen Elizabeth I granted the East India Company a perpetual monopoly on trade with the subcontinent. This trade gradually developed in jewels, pepper, textiles, saltpeter, and the East India Company established bases in Madras and Calcutta. Its founding charter authorized it to wage war. So there was this clause. Eventually, this company would evolve from a trading corporation with a security force to a mighty army with a trading division which conquered all of India. By the 1750s, the East India Company contributed £1 million out of Britain's £8 million of import trade. By 1802, it had captured most of the subcontinent's richest areas and set itself up as a regent to the Mughal Emperor. effectively it had gained both administrative and complete revenue control of most of the subcontinent. This is something that was completely unthinkable. So the question is, how did the East India Company, a private company, successfully conquer India? There were three main reasons for this. The arrival and the rise of the East India Company coincided with the fracturing of the Mughal India into tiny competing states. Europeans also had an edge because of their military innovations and their superior armaments. And also this invention of the joint stock company enabled the East India Company to raise vast monies for these type of risky ventures. In an additional important factor was that the East India Company enjoyed great support from the British Parliament. Dalrymple argues that the East India Company probably invented corporate lobby. He says that the British returnees from India used their wealth to buy MPs in the British Parliament, as well as parliamentary seats for themselves. In turn, the Parliament backed the East India Company with state power. Eventually, the East India Company accounted for half of Britain's trade. And in Dalrymple's world, it became too big to fail. The East India Company was bailed out in 773 by Parliament when it went bust. In his epilogue, Dalrymple argues, and this is the main argument it seems that he's making, that the East India Company remains today history's most ominous warning about the potential for the abuse of corporate power. So that is basically the theme behind the book, Mulana.
Now, Mulana, what are some of the events that are covered in the book?
The first half of the book begins with the company's dominance over Bengal and the clashes with the Nawabs for control. And this is largely conducted by the figure of Robert Clive, a very brutish and cunning person, who uses subterfuge and aggression and warned the company the Mughal right as what is called the Diwani, or the economic controller then of Bengal. Was Bengal arguably the richest region in the world at that time, probably now under the company's control after 1757, the East India Company then gained the dominant position in India. Company officials engaged in a systematic orgy of asset stripping of Bengal, contributing then to Bengal's worst famines, which killed millions. Rather than organize effective tax or famine relief, as was common among the Indian rulers, the company maintained its tax harvesting to sustain a higher share price. So this part of the book traces the history of a very refined Shah Alam. He was a poet also, and a despotic Siraj ad-Daula. It examines the manipulations of the East India Company's Robert Clive. Robert Clive was victorious at the Battle of Plassey, and Siraj ad-Daula was able to defeat the British in Calcutta. This led to the company declaring war on Siraj ad-Daula. This was the first time that the East India Company declared war on an Indian prince. The very powerful bankers and traders, the Jagat Seths, who were Marwani Jain bankers and kingmakers, really plotted with the general of Siraj ad-Daula to stage a coup on behalf of the company for a bribe. Clive accepted the bribe, and this led to the Battle of Plassey in 1757. This Battle of Plassey in 1757 was where the East India Company then won control of Bengal. And Dalrymple presents it as a palace coup, where these Bengali bankers paid the East India Company more than 4 million, which would be 400 million pounds in our times, to unseat the disliked Nawab of Bengal. And the East India Company's rule then quickly became really one of pillage of Bengal. These Jagat Seths, these bankers, became even more rich. And the company now entered into this era of unlimited looting and possession of Indian assets. In Chapter 4, he shows us how the Indian countryside was brutally looted by the company. And the author, Dalrymple, reminds us that one of the first Indian words to enter into the English language from India was, in fact, this word loot. In 1760, when Clive returned to Europe, he returned with so much wealth that was not seen in Europe before that. In the meanwhile, Mir Jafar, became the new Nawab of Bengal. He was from Najaf in Iran. He was a very uneducated scholar, soldier, and he increased the chaos that Bengal was already experiencing. He wore bracelets decorated with 7 different precious stones on each wrist, and he paid little attention to paying his soldiers even. The soldiers and the nobles regularly rebelled because of his attitude. Meanwhile, Shah Alam, the Mughal emperor, so to say, who was supposed to be the emperor, was still wandering in the countryside. And when he eventually arrived in Bengal, soldiers and nobles joined Shah Alam, who was this candidate heir to the Mughal Empire. In a sense, he was then a threat to Mir Jafar and also the company. They tried to take him out in the Battle of Halsa in 1761, but he managed to flee. The company then appointed Mir Qasim, who then came into conflict with the company later on. And in the next chapter, we read about the defeat of Mir Qasim and the further strengthening of the company, as well as an agreement then between Robert Clive and Shah Alam, that the company will recognize Shah Alam as the Mughal emperor in exchange for the Diwani, in other words, this economic exchange office. And Shah Alam agreed then to receive 2.6 million rupees. And the British effectively then continued to rule Bengal for the next 200 years. With all the country's wealth now transferred to London, it was a disaster for the people of Bengal and India. But this was not the worst yet, because there was famine, but the company continued with the taxation and in cases even increased the taxation. As a result, 1.2 million Bengalis died of famine or disease. Robert Clive eventually returns to England and he commits suicide. And at this point in the book, we are introduced to two old enemies of the East India Company, the Marathas and also the Sultan of Mysore, Haider Ali, and his brave son Tipu Sultan. The Marathas were good at military intelligence, and the Sultan of Mysore, had a very strong army that received French military training, and the army were equipped with French armaments. So they formed an alliance and won a major victory against the British. Hastings was the company representative at that time. Unfortunately, he was soon able to make a recovery breakthrough with a combination of military victories and diplomacy. This led then to a peace treaty between the parties in 1782. After this, the company enemies never had an opportunity to defeat them again. In the meanwhile, Shah Alam was becoming very frustrated by the fact that the company had not kept their promise to make him a Mughal emperor. So he was determined to take his country back, and he allied with the Marathas. With an army of 16,000, he was able to take Delhi back and ascend to the peacock throne. He was able to take back also some of the surrounding areas, and the income then that he got from those areas and those lands led to a cultural and an economic recovery of Delhi. Shah Alam met with many problems and became completely dependent on the Marathas. When the Marathas did not allocate a stipend for the palace, in Delhi, even the royals then went hungry. Shah Alam's adopted son, Ghulam Qadir, took revenge on the king in 1788 and attacked the Delhi palace, raped his household and killed them. He plundered all the treasures of the court and cut out the eyes of the old emperor Shah Alam. The Marathas intervened and saved the life of Shah Alam, but it was too late because this last lion of the Mughal emperor had lost his teeth. After the revolution in America, the company was very concerned that it should not lose India to British who had made India their homes, who were of big mixed birth. Tipu Sultan then fought the British in the Third Anglo-Mysore War. The British were not always victorious. In 1780, for example, its regiment had been completely wiped out. If only the triple alliance of the Hyderabadis, Marathas, and Tipu Sultan had held together, then the East India Company would have been completely defeated and removed from India. It also tells us of the bravery of Tipu Sultan in the Fourth Anglo-Mysore War, where he was martyred at the siege of Seringapatam. And this is told very well here in this book. The only remaining opposition to the British was Shah Alam and the Marathas. And the Marathas, however, were reduced because of internal fighting, and they became warring factions. One of the groups, in fact, joined the British. This made the British very strong. They now had an army of over 155,000 soldiers, and they were able to defeat the Marathas as a result of this. Shah Alam had the choice at this point either to side with the French or the British, and he sided with the British. In 1803, the British confronted the French at the Battle of Delhi, and the British victory here meant that India would be under British control for another 144 years. By 1803, when the East India Company conquered Delhi, it had a private army numbering nearly 200,000 men, and they were able to then administer the entire continent. After the mutiny in 1857, the company killed tens of thousands of people, including, we know, many ulama. But 2 years later, then the British there was questions that how can a company be run by a board? So eventually, then the British Parliament decided to disband the company, and all conquered territories were then given to the British royalty, and Queen Victoria then became the ruler of India instead of a board. And the company contract in India expired silently in 1874.
Now, Milan, what is the difference between this book and William Dalrymple's other books that we have reviewed on the program, also about India?
That's a very good question. I think that in The Last Mughal and White Mughals, there are fewer characters. Here, there's a bigger canvas that the author employs. There's the British, the Mughals, the Marathas, the Afghans, the Nawab personalities, all of these people come into play.
Mm. And then, Maulana, what are the sources that the author uses for his history?
Well, there's a number of both British and Indian sources. He has access to the company records, which are still quite intact. And also, one of his important sources is Ghulam Hussein Khan, who Dalrymple says is a most perceptive historian of the 18th century India, and he left a detailed eyewitness account of events. So Dalrymple quotes from this extensively. We see many quotations from these Indian histories as well. And there are about 100 pages just of notes and references and a bibliography at the end.
And then, Maulana, who will find this book interesting? It's quite a lengthy book, as Maulana showed me in the picture as well. And also the price and where the book is available.
Well, I think those people interested in the story of colonialism, certainly India and Muslim history in India, and also those people interested in globalization, really, and how globalization affects the world. Because in the sense, the East India Company was the original rapacious corporate entity that really impacts on the lives of people far beyond its original scope. So I think that is the type of interest that the people may find in the book. Mm. As far as the price of the book, the book is available from our local bookshop here, Exclusive Books, and it costs 358 rand or more.
Jazakumullah khairan, Maulana, for joining us this morning on the program. Anything else Maulana would like to add about the book?
No, I think it's a good read, certainly, and the author is very engaging in his way. So apart from the fact that it goes through a lot of history, it really does it in a way that keeps the reader quite engaged throughout the book. So it's a worthwhile read, Maulana.
Jazakumullah khairan, Maulana, for joining us this morning on the program. And inshallah, we will speak to you next week.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.